It's your time to Ed Up with America's leading higher education podcast network, the Ed Up Experience, where we make education your business. This is Ed Up Legal with your host, Patty Roberts. She's Dean at St. Mary's School of Law, and she's going to be leading conversations about legal education in today's world. Now let's hear from your host, Patty Roberts.
Welcome to Ed Up Legal. My name is Patty Roberts, and I'm coming to you from St. Mary's University School of Law. Today, we have on our show Verna Williams, who has served as Dean at the University of Cincinnati College of Law since spring of 2019. But Dean Williams was no stranger to the College of Law because she taught there since 2001. So Dean Williams, tell me a little bit about what prompted you after nearly two decades on the faculty to consider becoming the dean there.
Well, I kind of consider myself an accidental dean. In fact, as with many things in my life, my words came back to bite me or haunt me. I once even said that being the dean was the worst job at the college.
I hope you feel differently now.
I do. I mean, I was just, you know, I enjoyed teaching my courses, engaging in scholarship, and I co-founded and co-ran a center for race, gender, and social justice. So I was pretty fine with my situation as a faculty member. But in 2017, the provost dismissed our dean, and we needed somebody to step up. And my colleagues encouraged me to apply for the position. And so I thought, okay, you know, I can try this out. It probably won't take that long. And of course, I don't know how long it will take, but it'll be a good way to serve since I've avoided serving in administrative capacities in other ways. And so that's why I decided to try to apply for the interim position. And when I got it, I could tell pretty soon, like really within the first week, that it was a good fit for me.
Oh, that's terrific. So the accident didn't take very long to happen. You fell right into it.
I really did. It just really reawakened some of those muscles that I had used, that I exercised in practice, you know, years before I came to Cincinnati, because as the dean, you're the advocate for your institution. You work in coalition with other deans, with different stakeholder groups like alumni, your community, and you know, we are dealing with different issues from day to day. Sometimes you literally just don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, at a different point in my life, I hated that, but I was at a point in my life where I really liked that. I got a kick out of it. So, you know, the combination of the variety of things to do, interacting with people and, you know, working to make our law school the best it can be really was something that resonated with me.
That's outstanding. I say the worst job in legal education is vice dean. That job was really, really hard. But being dean, I really understand what you're saying. I love the fact that every day is unpredictable. Like you'll have your schedule and maybe some of those meetings will happen, but they will not end up as you think. And there'll be surprises coming at you from every direction, but that can be fun.
It can be. Now, of course, we're still in the midst of the biggest surprise that none of us ever imagined, you know, the pandemic. We just start, you know, I start thinking, okay, well, we have to operate in a new realm and a new way. We shouldn't let this keep us from moving forward. So let's just keep going, recognizing that it's difficult, recognizing that it's stressful. We can still make some progress. And I'm proud to say that we did.
I'm so glad. Yeah, that's one big obstacle and unexpected thing I also could have done without.
Yeah,
same. Here we are.
Yeah, but I think that's also part of the personality that makes you more amenable to being the dean. I mean, if you're the kind of person that will say, okay, well, here's the silver lining of this. There's something I can learn from this. Then you might be well suited to be a dean. If you're on the other hand, you're thinking, oh my God, this is the worst. I can't cope. I want things back the way they are. It may not be your thing.
That is very good advice. The pandemic threshold question. Would that be okay? Yeah. Well, our listeners can't see what I see, but behind you, there is a picture of a beautiful, well-lit, brand new building. And I think that we were talking before, you're subliminally trying to tell us all that you have great new digs on the horizon. So can you tell us about the new building, how that's come about?
Oh, I'm thrilled. This has been something that's been in the works for, I think, at least 10 years. And it's, you know, because we sadly needed it. We sorely needed it, I should say. We are going to move from the corner that we have occupied since 1925, a long, long time. And the building that we now occupy is actually wrapped around the original structure that was there. So, you know, we were sustainable before sustainability was cool. And we're moving to a more centrally located place on campus, right across from the business school. And our new building is just going to be beautiful. It's going to really be very light-filled, airy, lots of spaces for students to congregate and formally and informally. And I think it'll be the kind of place that will really help to encourage the kinds of interactions that we are known for. So the interactions between students and faculty, bringing in other folks from other parts of campus, because we'll be so much more centrally located. When we're, you know, at the corner of Clifton and Calhoun, where we currently are, we're kind of off to ourselves, our own little silo, but now we're right in the middle of things. And right next to the library, sandwiched in between two Starbucks and a Tim Hortons. I think, you know, that'll make us attractive. Yes, yes, if only for caffeine. We also will be in what's called the Cincinnati Innovation District. Part of that's anchored by our 1819 Innovation Hub, which is a place that University of Cincinnati has worked with different corporations that are headquartered there, working to collaborate between the university and those corporations. And we also are building a digital futures structure that's going to be the focus of digital humanities. So there's a lot of really interesting, cutting edge, innovative kind of things going on there. And I fully expect the College of Law to be right in the thick of it. And we'll move in the summer. So it's really happening. It's really happening.
Really, that is so exciting. So one of the things I was talking recently to Dean Baines, the University of Houston, and he of course is also excited about his new building. And he shared the kind of the fundraising journey to that new building. How did you convince people to donate to this beautiful light-filled space?
Well, it's a lot of it is appealing to their desire to see us continue to move forward, to be innovative, and to provide our students with the type of space where they can really engage in the transformative education that we provide. That many of them, you know, they remember when they were in the law school, and some of them were in that original 1925 building. You know, some of them were in the new building, the newish building where we are, when that construction was going on. And they're just excited to see the progress. I think that's one of the things that really appeals to alums about supporting this kind of venture. And we also got money from the state, which is really wonderful. I think that represents a real investment in the legal education.
Great. So you are not just innovating in your physical structure. I know that you have some new programs coming online. One that just started in January, your Master of Legal Studies. Can you tell us more about that?
Happy to. Our Master of Legal Studies is designed for professionals that are working in what we sometimes call legal adjacent fields. That is professionals who are working with the law, but who don't have to have a JD. So here we're focusing on folks that are in compliance primarily, people in human relations. And it's a two-year program. It's 100% online. And the idea is that as time goes on, we will be able to add more courses that will help people in legally adjacent fields in healthcare, for example, or higher ed even. We are getting some folks that are employed at the University of Cincinnati that are in our program. And so we also are offering some courses that we believe will appeal to our JD students. We'll have those in the summer. So this program is something that I see as increasing access to legal knowledge, helping these professionals who can benefit by understanding the law. And it'll provide some flexibility for our JD students, offering them an opportunity to get additional credits during the summer down the line. And I'm very pleased to report that we launched it in January, and we've got a few more students than we were anticipating, which is always nice. And to my surprise, our consultants on campus, we actually have a unit on campus that focuses 100% on online learning and does a really wonderful job. When they did the market research for our program, they said that, we could count on getting people from Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky. Those are the states that are in our region. And we did get those, but we've also got a student from Wyoming and from Florida, which is really very cool. So we're really happy with this first group of students, and they're very excited to be the first students in this program. And I see this as something that's really got legs, something that can really help us expand course offerings, expand access to legal knowledge, and all to the benefit of the College of Law. The other thing that we've got going, since I think I know what you're going to ask me, the other program that we're getting ready to launch in the fall is the Legal Access Clinic. And this clinic, it was inspired by a collaboration that we have with the Hamilton County Municipal Court. Cincinnati is located in Hamilton County. And the clerk of the court happened to be a University of Cincinnati alumnus, and he wanted to work with us to assist the many unrepresented litigants coming to court. As you probably know, Dean Roberts, the access to justice gap is huge. And in Hamilton County, something like 90% of litigants to the court have no lawyers. So with the clerk, we established the Help Center, which is staffed by two attorneys that are UC employees, as well as by volunteers, lawyers who volunteer, and students. And they assist litigants with things as basic as helping them to locate courtrooms or things that are much more complicated, like dealing with a proposed eviction or a collection matter. And so I was just really thrilled that we were participating in this. The Help Center has helped thousands and thousands and thousands of people, literally that many. And I wondered, what else can we do to help this population? And the vehicle we came up with was this Legal Access Clinic. And the target population will be people who earn too much to qualify for legal aid, but too little to afford an attorney on their own. And we brought on board our clinic director, and she currently is getting out into the community, just getting a sense of what the needs are so she can properly determine what the scope of services will be. But I'm very excited about us launching this clinic in the fall.
Well, congratulations on both of those things. I mean, the Legal Access Clinic, you're hitting the sweet spot, right? The people who really desperately need help and just don't have access because of where they fall on their income scale. So I applaud your work in that area. Anything we can do to increase the access to justice is a plus.
Yes.
And the Master of Legal Studies, that's exciting too. We have a Master of Jurisprudence program that is, people know that in this space, right? It's the same thing, but it's masters. Some people call it Masters of Legal Studies and some call it Master of Jurisprudence. We're in our sixth year and it's been wildly successful for just the reasons you say. You know, there are people out there who should be able to obtain a quality legal education, even if they're not going to pass the bar and represent clients. There are a lot of people who will benefit from that. So I'm excited about your inaugural class and look forward to learning more as the program expands. One of the things that we were talking about before we started recording is how the University of Cincinnati is known for its social justice focus. I know that's consistent with your prior practice of law when you practiced in the area of civil and women's rights. And of course, when you were there at the University of Cincinnati co-directing the college's Judge Nathaniel Jones Center for Race, Gender, and Social Justice. And I wonder if you can tell me how your social justice experience in practice and with the center now informs your deanship and what you see as the expansions of social justice initiatives beyond what we've just talked about under your deanship.
Before I entered the academy, I practiced for, I've been out so long now, it's been so long since I graduated, I sort of lost track of how long I did what. I know that I've been in the academy for 21 years. I practiced for something like, 12 years, eight years of which were at the National Women's Law Center. And it's at the National Women's Law Center that I really, I think I just sort of, found my footing. And it's sort of like the deanship in that at the center, at the National Women's Law Center, I practice in lots of different ways. I engaged in public education, so teaching people about law, different aspects of law, like the earned income tax credit, the child and dependent care credit, so helping lay people understand those things. Appellate advocacy, I handled a case that dealt with the question of whether Title IX required schools to address student-on-student harassment. And that case went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I wrote law review articles. I worked in coalition with different groups to get policies enacted in federal government or in Congress. And so it gave me this sort of holistic view or 360-degree view of how the law can operate and how it can make change or different ways to make change. And so that's the perspective I brought to the University of Cincinnati College of Law. In fact, I was attracted to UC College of Law because they had a joint degree program in law and women's studies. And that's the kernel from which grew our Center for Race, Gender, and Social Justice. We decided to call it a center focusing on race, gender, and social justice because we wanted to be intersectional in our approach. And again, I think that's sort of, it's definitely rooted in my experience at the center, indeed my experience as an African-American woman, knowing that there are race and gender and there are all these other different intersecting identities that have an effect on how people operate in the world. And in that sense, when I'm looking at our programs, I'm thinking about what are the ways in which our students can, one, learn these things, learn that there's just so much that one can do as an attorney. And in the process of doing it, how can they help our community? Because as a lawyer, one of the obligations one has is to serve. And that's really how I approach it. So even, we've mentioned the Legal Access Clinic. We have other clinics like the Ohio Innocence Project, which is one of the most successful in the global innocence movement. I mean, these seem very obvious social justice type clinics, but we also have an entrepreneurship and community development clinic, which, at first glance, one may not think that there are any social justice angles to it, but in a city like Cincinnati, which is about 43% African-American, you've got people of color, growing numbers of immigrants coming to Cincinnati, and folks that are looking to start their own businesses and get a foothold, an economic foothold in the community. And our students through the ECDC, Entrepreneurship and Community Development Clinic, they're helping those folks. They're helping them turn the food truck into a brick and mortar establishment, helping them get their businesses off the ground by filing the necessary papers and such. And we turn it into, again, a sort of a 360-degree experience by, if we can, working with those clients. So for example, at our holiday party, the caterers were our clients, one of our clients from the ECDC.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. 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 And it happened to be, I think it was a Black owned business on top of it. So I think that, and particularly at this moment, I think our community is in alignment about the need to live our values. So you know, the students are oriented towards, I want to get a degree. I want to get a law degree because I want to make a difference. I want to make a difference in this community in which I live. And I want to make sure that the administration is living those values as well. So that's, I hope that answers the question.
Oh, it absolutely does. And it actually triggers all sorts of questions. And I'll try to winnow them down. First, what was that experience like successfully arguing before the United States Supreme Court? I mean, there are so few people who can say that, and bravo to you. Share a little bit about that experience.
Sure, you're right. There are few. It's a small number of people. It's a very small number of Black women. I feel like I have to say that, you know, given the current discussion about Mr. Biden's promise to appoint a Black woman to the U.S. Supreme Court. And it was probably just what you imagine. I mean, you know, very intense, you know, lots of questions. I mean, it was the kind of thing I'll just, you know, to candidly, I actually thought I was pregnant because I was nauseous like the whole time. I had these terrible nightmares that I was going to, when I stood up at the podium, that I was going to vomit. I mean, I was just so, so nervous. But the level of preparation, it's that experience really, I think, that opened my mind to being an academic. This was also another case of my words coming back to haunt me. I also thought, I'm not professor material. I'm very practical. I want, you know, to make a difference. The last thing I see myself doing is writing some law review articles with footnotes as long as my forearm. but I got into arguing, and I'll say, I got all my oral advocacy experience in this case. My first oral argument was in front of the 11th Circuit, in front of a 3-judge panel. My second oral argument was in front of the en banc panel in the 11th Circuit. And my third and final oral argument was in front of the United States Supreme Court.
Okay, so that's a heck of a rise to the top there. Williams, you raced right to the finish line.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, that gave me, once I got to the, when you get to the Supreme Court level and you're thinking, okay, these are the people who, they make the decisions, or I write the songs. I had that Barry Manilow song in my head. They're thinking about not just my case, but related cases, trying to figure out, where does my case fit in? What are the implications of my case on their jurisprudence? I mean, it was a whole different way of thinking about it. In addition to thinking about which justice can we get, you know, we thought, well, we've got four. Who are we more likely to get? Back then, Justice O'Connor on the court, we thought that we had a good shot with her. And so it was a matter of asking myself lots of questions, every single question I thought the court could ask, and practicing and practicing and practicing. And so by the time the day came and Justice O'Connor asked the first question, I was able to answer. I thought, oh, okay, I can do this.
I'm doing it, and I'm not throwing up.
Yeah, I'm not throwing up. It's, you know, it's fine. It's all good.
Wow.
Yeah. So it, you know, I just felt this, it was like a sense of calm, you know, I was sort of like in, you know, the flow that they talk about. So that's what it was like. And I think from that, I thought, wow, do I want to do that again? I'm like, no, I don't think I want to do that again.
Well, you had nowhere to move from there, right? You would have had to keep practicing in the Supreme Court.
Right. There's
no
higher
court.
Yeah. And I just, you know, but I liked the depth, the ability to go really deep. And I think that's what made me think about teaching.
Right. Well, thank goodness for that case, because now you are Dean of the University of Cincinnati, making a huge difference in the academy. I would be remiss, I think, if I didn't harken back to your early days of appellate advocacy training, when you were on moot court with someone that our listeners might recognize the name of. So who was your moot court partner?
Well, it would be, back then she was known as Michelle Robinson. Today she's known as Michelle Obama. And it was actually first year, the advocacy experience that all first years have to have. So we did, our case was a criminal one, and we had two parts to it. One was an evidentiary hearing, and the second part was the actual trial. So yeah, we were in the same section in first year. And I remember seeing her in class, listening to her, and thinking, wow, she's really smart. I better ask her to be my partner before somebody else does. And so
that turned out to be a smart move.
It did.
And for her that she said yes.
Yeah. I mean, she was great to work with. She was, you know, you just never know in a situation like that, right? You might get somebody who's either not going to do the work or who's going to be so anal and just, you know, pain that it's just an awful experience. But she was just that right mix of fun and serious. And from there, that sparked our friendship. And we've been friends ever since first year of law school.
So before I ask a little more about that, I want to say to the law students out there, be friendly and supportive to all of your classmates, because one of them might end up being, oh, I don't know, the First Lady of the United States, or maybe or the president of the United States, and a whole host of things in between. But you were very involved in Michelle Obama's book, from what I read.
Yes. After her husband was elected president, she asked me to help her out with a project. She wanted to record her time in the White House and in preparation for writing a book for when the time was over. And I said, absolutely. I, you know, didn't hesitate. I was happy to be able to help and really happy that she asked. I'm really happy that she asked. I'm very honored. And so for 8 years, I go to the White House a couple of times a year and would just sit down with her. We'd have like marathon sessions where we would talk about what had been going on the past several months, and I'd record it, and then I would take notes because I was really paranoid about losing everything. And it was really great. I mean, one, because I got to spend some serious quality time with her in a way that you don't get to do when you're a grown-up and you've got a job and you've got kids and your family and all that stuff. So yeah, we got some real quality girlfriend time. But also, you know, it was a great project. I mean, how often do you get to go to the White House and talk to the First Lady and, you know, have your own parenthetical discussions about, well, here's what I think is happening, or here's what I thought about this policy. It was just really tremendous. It was also nerve-wracking. As you probably are picking up, I have a little bit of anxiety. The first few times that I went to the White House, I mean, it was just kind of mind-blowing. My hands were shaking because the White House is like being in a museum that people live in. And it's just, you know, it's my friend that I've known for many years. She's still the First Lady. Her husband's still the president. It took a while to get used to it. It just does. You know, it went really well. And then she wrote the book and she was very generous in crediting me because, you know, a lot of the stuff she decided to go a different way than when we originally started out. But, you know, I'm happy to have performed that service. She's got all that material. I forget, they say in the book how many hours of tape and pages of notes that I took. But it was wonderful. I was her oral historian.
Oh, what an incredible experience. What a testament to how much respect she must have for you and your friendship that she asked you to do this. And frankly, I'm going to say like the top faculty scholarship assignment that I've ever heard. Wow, that was really incredible. Well, thank you for sharing that. And I honestly feel like I could talk to you all afternoon. This has really been fun, but we're going to keep it short for our listeners. And I'm going to wrap up by asking you, what is it you anticipate will be the evolution of legal education in the coming decade? And if the answer is different, how should it evolve? How is it likely to evolve? And then how should it?
Okay, huh. Well, I'm going to take the easy way out and say likely and should are the same.
Good.
I'm sure listeners to this podcast are familiar with the challenges that are confronting legal education in terms of enrollments. And, you know, frankly, all of higher ed is going to confront a challenge because of the population drop. And so that's something that we're going to have to address. And I guess the question is, on the legal education side, I think we'll see more programs like the ones that we have at our schools that are teaching new learners. And, you know, because it's so apparent that there is a lack of understanding about our legal system and even our system of government. So in some way, shape, or form, I think law schools are going to be the places that are helping to provide that type of education either to undergraduates or, you know, maybe even, you know, maybe there'll be even be some things that are going into the high school levels. I'm just thinking out loud here. And I also think, we will continue. There's been so much more of a turn toward practice and making sure that people are ready for practice. I think we will refine what that means. And I think maybe get more realistic about what that means. And by that, I'm just trying to suggest that law school is not like medical school. They deal with the living body. We deal with the living body of law. So there's no way that somebody can memorize and know everything. They've got to be adept at learning and be committed to being a student for the rest of their lives. And so I think there's going to be much more emphasis on that, in addition to providing the students with more opportunities to practice so that they can at least get their feet wet doing things that junior associates should be able to do, or junior lawyers should be able to do. And I think, and when I say associates, that also made me wonder, you know, how many more positions like that are there going to be? Because it seems like in the legal field, a lot of the jobs that people used to do when probably you and I first started out, those things are getting, actually artificial intelligence can do those
right
things.
Yeah. Interview, yeah. Discovery stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that those jobs are off the table. So it's going to require a higher level of thinking and capacity on the part of junior lawyers to be marketable. And so I think law schools will be looking at how to do that.
Well, I think you're right. We have a tall task ahead of ourselves because the profession is changing faster than our education institutions are changing.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think we have been helped though, and this is that whole decanal, you know, glass half full philosophy, by the pandemic. Whereas before the pandemic, a lot of grumbling about, well, what would we use technology for? Do we really need to get involved in it? Things aren't moving that quickly. Now we see, oh yeah, technology, it really is the future. And we've just sort of touched the surface of how it can really assist us and what we might expect to see in practice. So I think there's going to be even more emphasis on that and more emphasis even on making sure students are adept at working with technology willing to be lifelong learners in that respect too.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Dean Williams. This has really been enjoyable, and I look forward to learning more about the MLS as it expands and your social justice legal access clinic, and then seeing that beautiful building, hopefully in person.
Oh yeah, we're gonna be the site for all the conferences.
Excellent.
Yes. Yeah, I already see that in the future. You know, people are gonna have to come. And you know, Cincinnati is a really lovely city. It really is. And we got a lot of great things happening, especially right now with the Bengals and you know, and the Super Bowl. A lot of great energy in Cincinnati. So you'll see us again.
Oh, I'm certain. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Dean Roberts. Thank you for having me.
This has been another episode of EdUp Legal with your host, Patty Roberts. EdUp Legal is part of the EdUp Experience podcast network, bringing you the brightest and most influential minds across higher education and beyond. Here at EdUp, we make education your business.